All right, it's the Fan Pregame. Justin Cuthbert and Ben Ennis with you until 7 p.m. And Ben, we begin where we left off last night. More information on a Spygate scenario involving the Canadian women's national team. We got two staffers set packing, leaving Paris. A self-imposed, for now, punishment for Bev Priestman, the manager of Canada. And yeah, a group of defending gold medalists dealing with a serious curveball here. Are you feeling secondhand shame watching this all unfold?
I'm not feeling secondhand shame. I am feeling a little bit confused considering we're the defending gold medalists and we're spying on New Zealand, who is the first matchup for the Canadian women. But we shouldn't need to spy on New Zealand. I guess this is kind of par for the course because if you go back to the original Spygate, Bill Belichick's Spygate, he was spying on a Jets team in a regular season game. That was a Jets team that went 4-12 that year. So kind of par for the course for these teams that spy on other teams. It doesn't matter the quality of competition, but it's a little bit confusing. I would love to hear an honest accounting as to what happened there. I don't know if we're ever going to get that. I'd love to hear it, though.
Yeah, I would, too. And I don't know if we're going to get it. I guess, you know, when this all settles, when the Olympics are over, we might get some more information. But this does bother me. The perception of this Canadian women's national team has always been such where they're undersold in some ways and they're always overshooting expectation. And I think we've reached the point in this country where we're done sort of just defending blindly any Canadian athlete. Like, I feel like I did that maybe when I was younger. It was just a little naive because we have so many athletes now. We got good ones. We got bad ones. Some that give us pride, some that don't. But with this team, it has provided a lot of that patriotic vibe and that pride in the country and the flag. And now I look at this team and the one that's always undervalued, and people are going to have an excuse for their success. They're going to have material now if they fail at these games. And I just don't feel like that's fair given what this team has done pound for pound for this country and in big spots like the Olympic Games.
Yeah, it's a lose-lose situation for them, no doubt. I mean, you beat New Zealand, a team you're supposed to beat, a team that you're better than, and obviously people are going to point to a potential unfair advantage you had because of the spying on their practice. If you lose, I mean, the rest of the sporting world is rooting against Canada. Mm-hmm. That's not something we're used to, but there's just no question any neutral observer is not going to be rooting. Who rooted for Bill Belichick? Probably the same people that were rooting against him before Spygate, but there was more after Spygate and those New England Patriots teams. I mean, we're Bill Belichick. We're the Patriots until further notice. And the other part of this, I don't know how many other teams are doing things similar to this. Like, how prevalent is this type of subterfuge in the world of women's soccer? I'm not sure.
Well, at least, you know, if there's something to, you know, feel better about, is that there is precedent for this being swept under the rug quite quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, Jim Harbaugh with Michigan won a national title last year, was suspended for a half of football, got a promotion to the L.A. Chargers and a big old bag of cash. And yeah, we celebrate Jim Harbaugh as a great football coach. So these things can work themselves out. But for now, yeah, Canada, public enemy number one at the Olympics. A little time for preamble because Arash Madani is standing by from Paris, and it's late in Paris right now. So let's get to Arash Madani from Paris, who's been covering this story. His timeline has all the important information. I'm hoping, Arash, you can kind of distill the last 24 hours here for us. This Canada soccer story, the drones, the suspensions that have, or at least the plane ticket home so far. You know, can you give us kind of the Coles notes and where we're at with this story right now in Paris?
Yeah, let's try and get some context into this. These are the Olympic Games where they spend around $4 billion in security, where there are cameras everywhere, and among the terrorist threats are drones. So this very quickly, guys, did not become a sports issue. This became pilot of the drone said uncredentialed staff member. He got arrested. He got detained. He could have spent up to a year in prison and a 35,000 euro fine. They gave him an 8-month suspended sentence. This is far beyond just sport from that standpoint, which makes you think and wonder, How stupid do you have to be at an Olympic Games to think that you could get a drone up there and go all Belichickian and Harbaugh-ian and whatever-ian and get away with it? Which makes you wonder, this really probably wasn't the first time, was it? How long may or may this have been or not been standard operating procedure? And what the Canadian Olympic Committee and what Canada Soccer wants all of us to believe is that this was just two rogue staff members who orchestrated this entire thing. You know, the CEO of the Canadian Olympic Committee, David Shoemaker, said, Bev Priestman knew nothing about this. She told me so. And then Bev, today to the CBC, didn't answer the question of, did you know this was going on? She just did the very Canadian thing and apologized. Mm. So this is all far from over, by the way.
Yeah.
It's been a long day where the story has unfolded over and over again. FIFA's opened up a file, et cetera, et cetera. But right now it is damage control time by the COC and by Canada Soccer to keep this team in the tournament. That's all they're caring about right now.
Is that a realistic possibility? Because we know Bev Priestman is not going to be on the touchline for tomorrow's opening match. I mean, can you imagine, have there been possibilities floated? What could we be looking at in the coming days here for this Canadian team?
Well, New Zealand has come out and said, regardless of what happens in the match, they don't believe that Canada should get any points if it's a draw or a win. FIFA, in opening up the file this afternoon, guys, is looking into Canada Soccer as a federation, at Priestman, and at the two assistants who have been removed from the team and sent home. And so at this point, you have to believe there will be sanctions coming against Canada by FIFA. The question is when. Will it be within these 2 weeks or will it be after? Will they prevent Canada from being in some kind of international competition or suspend Priestman or down the road or now? So I think what you're seeing is by scapegoating two people, by having Priestman not sit on the bench, and by Canada Soccer saying we're going to launch an external review after the Olympics, I think what they're hoping is all of this will be enough for FIFA to back off. Because this is not the IOC's jurisdiction. FIFA runs the soccer tournaments at an Olympics, just like FIBA runs basketball, just like the International Tennis Federation runs the tennis event. So this is now FIFA's area, not the IOC's, and that's where things stand.
Do we have any intel on the mood of the team? Like, clearly this is not a great scenario, not a great situation for the Canadian team to be in. It's clearly not good for Bev Priestman, who, again, will not be on the touchline for the game, and who knows what's going to happen with her. But the team is separate from this story in some ways. They have the ability to go out there and play. They are uninhibited that way. What should we expect from them? Are they doing all right with all this cloud hanging over their head?
Yeah, it's a good question. And we don't know. They are literally 265 miles away. I didn't do the metric conversion. They're playing in the south of France. The soccer tournament is being played in stadiums all over the country. And only the medal rounds come back to Paris just because there's so much happening. So they're kind of sequestered out there. And I believe that outside of the CBC, who has one reporter assigned to the team for broadcast, I don't think anybody was there today. I bet there will be a few Canadian media and maybe other media in the aftermath of this, following what's going to happen in the lead up to match one and then maybe match two. You don't know. You know, it's a different team, too. Remember, this is the first major competition post-Sinclair.
Yes.
It's a new captain in Jesse Fleming. It's a different-looking locker room than it has been in World Cup and Olympics past. So it really is a question mark in terms of how the players may handle this.
So you're obviously in Paris. You're separate from the people that are covering the soccer. So I'm sure you've talked to people that are covering these games from other nations. Obviously, the opening ceremonies are going to be a big topic of conversation, but how high up the list of people's priorities and the conversation around Paris is this embarrassment for the Canadian women?
Pretty high. Pretty high. I mean, you know, to me, the question, guys, is how long has this potentially, allegedly, been standard operating procedure? Like, you can't, like, if we're going to be logical in all of this, do we really think this never, ever happened before at any other time? And they chose to come to the Olympics and do it for the first time twice for the same opponent at their practices. And do we really believe that the head coach knew nothing about this? Look, the scenarios have to be these. Either Priestman ordered the code red, Priestman knew about the code red, or if she didn't, what kind of control does she have over entire coaching staff coming off that World Cup debacle last summer into these Olympic Games? There are a lot of questions that remain unanswered because Priestman's not answering them. She's just apologizing. And the Canadian Olympic Committee is going out of its way to try and keep the team in this tournament. And they're just saying, we believe what Bev says. And Canada Soccer is going to do an external review. So it just doesn't add up. And people are asking, what's up? Because remember, they're the defending Olympic champions. You know, 3 years ago, they won the gold medal. So there's a lot of kind of layers and meat on the bone on this thing.
Yeah, it's been a hell of a 3 years here for Bev Priestman. It's interesting, right? Because, you know, she was in charge of the team that won the gold medal. She should have some sort of status entering these games. But you're right, the World Cup was a disaster. This is a disaster. Is it fair to completely question Bev Priestman's abilities altogether?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by abilities. Look, she's a good football coach, good soccer coach. I will say this. How did Bev Priestman get introduced to Canada and Canadians? With grand fanfare, they talked about how Priestman was the understudy to John Herdman. Now, there were allegations when Honduras came to BMO Field in Toronto to play against the men's national team when Herdman was coaching there. The Hondurans claimed through their media that there was a drone over their training the day before the match, a couple of days before the match, something like that. Nothing came of it. Now this. I don't know how many times those footballs got deflated, but I have a hard time believing that it just happened for the AFC Championship game.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, I think those are all fair comments and fair questions to be asking of this team. I also wonder, I mean, this isn't football, American football, where there's, I think, pretty obvious ways you can gain an advantage by filming somebody's practice, right? If you know their plays, you can game plan against them. And obviously there are set pieces and there's individual strategy. How much, though, can be gained, do you think, Arash, from actually filming somebody's practice?
The problem with that question, Ben, is that you're asking logically.
Yeah.
And name me a professional sports coach who's logical when it comes to these things. Like, I've been at football practices, Canadian football practices, where coaches are like I worked for two different CFL teams. A head coach would yell at me and be like, go run up there and see who that person is on like a Wednesday in July before a game, you know, week four game against the Alouettes. And I'm like, coach, that's the janitor. They're cleaning up because there was a concert here last night. Go see if he's got a camera.
Yeah.
They're looking for any edge, right? Like, you go to an NBA game, you go to the Olympic basketball here, the practices are all closed other than the shoot for the last 10 or 15 minutes for people to get footage. Coaches are paranoid beyond belief. They will do anything. If you're not cheating, you're not trying. They steal signals. They're looking for any little thing. And if it might be a set piece, if it's the personnel on a set piece, if it's personnel on some adjustments they may want to make, all of those things could weigh into it. What's the threshold? And if you have, like, the whole thing about all this is, I'm going to go back to what I opened with. These are the Olympic Games where there's cameras everywhere and security everywhere.
Did you really think you were going to get away with this? Really? Really?
Arash, you're a man of integrity. Your biases don't get in the way of things. So
Depends on the day.
Depends on the day. Okay, let's try this.
We're not talking about the Vikings.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe with the
Vikings.
We're good. Would it be a just fate for Canada if they were kicked out of this tournament in your mind?
I don't think it's going to happen. If you're not, I have a hard time believing they're going to kick Canada out after the first match. And I think it's way too much and way too quick to justify doing it now before the first match, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
The timeline is just too compressed. I think what's going to end up happening is that there will be sanctions and there will be discipline and there will be punishment in the aftermath of the Olympics. But I just think it's too tight a timeline for anything of real significance to happen now.
Yeah. It's tough for those players who had nothing to do with it, if in fact they had nothing to do with it. It's also tough for a couple of Olympians who get a great honor of being flag bearers today. I don't know how much of the shine was taken off. It kind of overshadowed a little bit, Arash. Did you feel for Maude Chiron and André Degrasse today?
Well, I think they took a lot of the shine off because I probably would have been telling you a lot about what André's been up to the last few years and who and what Maude Chiron's all about on this hit, if not for the soccer thing. Yeah, it did take away from it. There's a couple things that are cool about this. One, Maude Chiron, who won Olympic gold in Tokyo, weightlifter. She gets a call last week from a Canadian Olympic official saying, we need to talk to you, it's important. And she's like, oh bleep, I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
Like, imagine where your head goes a week before the Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
And they get on the call and they're like, you're going to be the flag bearer for the opening ceremony. And for both Chiron and Degrasse, they're week two athletes. They usually they're usually not even part of the opening ceremony because they're off in their camp and getting ready wherever they may be. You know, some of the athletes are in Germany, some are in Portugal, some are just kind of finding a camp before getting over here to Paris. So for both of them, it's neat. More for Chiron, I think, than Degrasse. André's a pretty laid-back guy. I think he's going to enjoy it. But for Chiron, I mean, this is it. Like, this means a ton to her. And she has to change weight classes in weightlifting these Olympics. Her previous weight class no longer exists in this competition. There's been a lot that she's had to prepare for. And so this is kind of the payoff that'll come on opening night when she gets to carry the flag.
Last one for you, Arash. You sat down recently with André Degrasse. Did you learn anything about him? Honestly, we learned something today. Like, he might be the best Olympian in the last 20 years for Canada, and yet it feels like he's sort of underrated. What did you learn from that conversation?
Yeah, totally. And it's really interesting because you think about Degrasse's Olympic career. He comes out as a kid in Rio, enters three events, wins three medals. Then he goes to Tokyo, wins the gold in the 200. Who knows what happens if he's not on the outside lane in the 100. And they have a silver medal from Tokyo in the 4x1. So he's entered six events, has six medals. If he does the same...
It's tight.
Careful now.
No way.
Yeah.
I shouldn't laugh, but...
Yeah.
That was intense.
I guess physical distancing is not a thing here when it comes to vehicles and humans. So if André wins three medals here, he'll become the most decorated Olympian in the history of Canada. And yet he's the most laid-back guy. Now, here's the thing. He hasn't run sub-10 flat in 3 years in the 100. And what he told me is he's working a ton on his starts. And that has been a real kind of point of emphasis. So how he comes out of the blocks is going to be key in all this. But guys, I don't know about you. One of my favorite Olympic moments was Atlanta 96 when Canada won the 4x100 relay gold, beating the Americans. And this 4x1 team, they won gold at the World Championships last year. They are for real. And if they do that, that's the kind of... André calls it a game 7.
Yeah.
The 4x1 relay team. So that to me is going to be one of the real moments of these Olympics.
He might be Mr. Game 7. Like, when it's the Olympic stage, we get the best of Andre de Grasse, which, if that's the legacy, that's a pretty good one. Arash, careful out there.
Yeah.
On the streets of Paris.
Nice French hospitality. Bad
to
happen.
Mom told me to stay safe. Now, I can tell you.
If you're listening on radio, bumped by a truck, it seemed like, during a hit there.
Yeah. I can tell you there are no drones in the air.
Yeah.
Here.
You could have used it for a lawsuit.
It would have
there.
Been a little conspicuous if you were talking about the Bev Priestman stuff and you got bumped out of the way by a truck. But yeah, you'd move past that. So I guess no conspiracy.
With a bunch of soccer balls in the back?
We appreciate the time, Arash. We enjoyed the timeline yesterday. Not that the news was great, but you've been covering a big story already for the Olympics well, and we look forward to your coverage down the stretch here.
All right. Thanks, guys.
It's Arash Madani covering Paris 2024 for Sportsnet.ca. Yeah, and can shrug off a truck, apparently. That was something else.
Yeah, that's, it wasn't the front of the truck. Perhaps this is like a new truck driver, didn't understand the physics involved with making a sharp right turn there. But Arash, pro that he is, was unfazed by being physically hit by a truck in the middle of an interview.
And again, we should describe kind of the side of the truck, a light bump.
Yeah,
but
hit by a truck.
By a truck, nonetheless, and a pro because he kept going for us. Okay, so the Toronto Blue Jays, they're back in action tonight on Sportsnet. A little news, though, for the Blue Jays before the show today. Mark Topkin of the Tampa Bay Times reporting that Kevin Kiermaier will retire at the end of the season. They had a conversation yesterday, I believe, or earlier today, but, you know, with the Tampa Bay Rays in town. Quote, this is it. 2024 is it for me. Of course, the Blue Jays are probably looking to move on from Kevin Kiermaier, but this is it, Ben. What's the Kevin Kiermaier legacy? I guess not in Toronto, but just overall, as a baseball player and a quality one at that.
Oh, I think we can carry it over to Toronto, despite it being just two seasons and only one really good one, one really memorable one. He was outstanding last year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not just defensively. I think defensively, there's an argument to be made that during his career, the best defender, infield, outfield, doesn't matter, in baseball. He was unbelievable. And when people were pulling for Kevin Pillar to win gold gloves and they were disappointed because Kevin Kiermaier was winning them. Mm-hmm. Maybe they didn't realize what kind of a defender he was until they got to see him every day last year, but the offense was above anything I ever expected out of him last season. He will go down in history as one of the great, great defenders of his era. I think most people, obviously, rightly, will remember him as a member of the Tampa Bay Rays. But yeah, pretty clearly, the offense is passed him by. That season that we got out of him a year ago did not translate this year, and everybody had their pick at his contract when he was exposed to waivers and decided thanks but no thanks. I think that was a pretty good indication to Kevin that it was probably the end of the line for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. He is such a Ray, so pretty fitting that Tampa Bay reporter did break the news that Kevin Kiermaier will or plan to retire at the end of the season. As mentioned, Blue Jays looking to bounce back after dropping the opener last night versus the Rays. It's Zach Eflin versus Yariel Rodriguez. Rodriguez starts are among the most interesting, I think, for the Blue Jays with what's left of this season. But interesting on the other side in that the Blue Jays have seen Eflin quite well so far this year. April 28th, before, you know, this thing kind of went sideways, 6 earned over 5 2/3. Blue Jays hit 3 home runs on that night. And on May 18th, they got him again, 4 runs on 9 hits across 6 innings. So that gives you the Blue Jays as favorites tonight. Do you have a lean in the Rays and Jays tonight?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would lean Blue Jays, but I would definitely lean over despite the under-hitting yesterday and these two teams having trouble scoring. We know these are also the two teams that have given up the most home runs in Major League Baseball. You mentioned the experience the Blue Jays have just this season against Zach Eflin with the 10 earned runs he's given up over a couple of starts. Yariel Rodriguez has been good since he returned from the IL, but still looking at like an 80-ish pitch count here, and that means the Blue Jays bullpen, which is second worst in all of Major League Baseball, is going to have to make an appearance here. So, yeah, if I was going to lean one way, I would lean over 8 between these two teams tonight down at Rogers Center.
Okay, I'm going Blue Jays. Canada to win a nil tomorrow.
All right.
-120. Little narrative pick. We have Frank Saravelli on the other side to discuss another scandal. That's next on the Fan Pregame. All right, back on the Fan Pregame, Justin Cuthbert and Ben Ennis. Ennis will be back on the morning show tomorrow, back with me on Friday. Looking forward again to setting records. It was a newsy day in the NHL, which is rare for July, with the Edmonton Oilers hiring Stan Bowman as their next general manager. Of course, Stan Bowman was a key figure in the Chicago Blackhawks scandal of 2010, excuse me. And it took him a while to get hired. And, of course, it comes with much controversy. To discuss that and a couple other nuggets in the NHL, we bring in Frank Cerebelli, one of our favorites of DailyFaceoff.com. What's going on, Frank?
How you doing, guys?
We're doing pretty well. An interesting day, of course, in the hockey world with Stan Bowman being hired by the Oilers. Let's start just pretty basic. The processes by which this hire was made. Of course, the Oilers took their time with this hire, and I think we understand why now. But there was a time where Stan Bowman wasn't eligible. So what changed, and why did the Oilers make this move?
Well, first step in the process had to be that Stan Bowman was eligible. And you hit on that in terms of the blessing from the NHL to have that suspension ended, from which he was unable to work in the National Hockey League. That came right on the heels of the draft and the Stanley Cup final. So that was a hugely important part of this. I think the Oilers had sort of had their eye on Stan Bowman for a while. I think even going back to the job that Jeff Jackson now holds as CEO of Hockey Ops, Stan Bowman was one of the people that the Oilers wanted to talk to a year ago for Jeff Jackson's role that ultimately they weren't able to make a hire for because he was ineligible to work. But I think if you really want to get the full story in terms of the process, there's multiple layers to this. There's a ton of nuance, but it really starts with the work that Stan Bowman did with Sheldon Kennedy and the Respect Group for a number of years, and not just, hey, this is community service, I'm getting my name back out there and rehabbing my image. Mm-hmm. No, this is, as Sheldon Kennedy put it in a press release that he put out to explain his side of the story, near full-time work from Stan Bowman writing the curriculum and then traveling around the continent to implement it in hockey locker rooms as part of the Respect Group and the process that they helped draw up with Stan Bowman's help that really landed him back in terms of a path to working in the NHL again.
And 3 years away from the NHL, is that long enough? Like if you look at the 3 years, and it was fall of 2021 in which he stepped down or was removed from his post with the Chicago Blackhawks, is that a long enough time away? And you mentioned what he's been doing in the interim. Is that enough?
It is for me, Ben. I mean, I think what we're talking about is, you know, again, let's hear directly from Stan Bowman about what he was told, when, and the reactions that everyone has to hearing that information. I'm told that the first time Stan Bowman actually heard the gruesome details in the allegations were when he read them in the Jenner Block report. That's a difficult spot for anyone to be in, but let's, instead of talk about hypotheticals, let's talk about the process again that we arrive at this point. One, Stan Bowman takes ownership and says that he could have done more. Two, he sits out and is ineligible to earn a living for a period of 3 years. Three, does the work that I just talked about. And then four, the other part of the story, which I found really interesting, that has kind of unfolded in the last couple of weeks here, is that it's pretty clear to me and many observers around the league that Stan Bowman has forged a relationship with the victim here in Kyle Beach and has, I don't know if it's fair to say befriended him, but at the very least, it seems like he gave his blessing to the Edmonton Oilers and Jeff Jackson from his communication that he had with Kyle Beach to then allow Stan Bowman to work in the NHL again. So a lot of boxes, Ben, have been checked to this point. I think we live in a society, though, where a lot of people don't want to hear this stuff, and they say that you should just lock him up, throw away the key, and he's done forever.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I think Stan Bowman and Joel Quenneville have received more punishment than the actual guy who did the abusing.
Yeah. You know, these are good things to hear. These are important details because a lot of people have been in positions where they have to do the work. And this is as detailed as I've heard anyone doing the work, which is a good thing, of course, for Stan Bowman, good for the Edmonton Oilers. And even if you're giving him the full benefit of the doubt on top of all the things you just laid out, the Oilers can't enter this partnership without criticism. So you're weighing the good and the bad. You're weighing whether the juice is worth the squeeze if you're Edmonton and they've decided to do that. So what did the Oilers see in Bowman? Why was he the choice? Why were they willing to accept everything that comes with hiring Stan Bowman in order to make him the Oilers general manager?
Well, he's an architect of a three-time Stanley Cup winning team with the Chicago Blackhawks. That's one part of it. He's also someone that I think has taken his time away from the game to reevaluate, and probably my guess would be that if you're sitting out for that long, you have a chance where Stan Bowman wasn't just sitting idle. I believe Stan Bowman was in contact with 30 plus NHL GMs over the last number of years, picking their brains, trying to understand the evolution of the game, even in that short period of time in which he isn't in the chair. And then the next part of the equation is, how does that fit in with the vision that Jeff Jackson has unfolding for this team, which you look at their press release today, the words in italics are best in class. Mm-hmm. That's what the Edmonton Oilers should be, with two of the very best players in the world. He's Jeff Jackson. He kind of put his own stamp on this team for the first time over the last 6 weeks since Ken Holland's contract expired as general manager, Hall of Fame general manager. But now it's up to Stan Bowman to then take that vision and see if it's in lockstep with Jeff Jackson, and then further continue to peck away at making the Oilers best in class around the entire NHL.
Yeah, it's not an apples to apples. Like, all these scenarios are different, but it's hard not to view this move through the prism of the Edmonton Oilers being the team that also went after Evander Kane, also went after Corey Perry. Have they found like a new market inefficiency? Is it wrong to look at those and view that as pretext to this moment in Oilers history? What's like? Have they learned from those experiences that, hey, maybe the blowback initially is rough, but we got through those pretty easily.
Yeah, I don't know if there even really was much blowback when it comes to Corey Perry. There was certainly some with Evander Kane. They took heat for a couple days, and Evander Kane came back and had an absolutely monster playoff run to help that team, then signed a four-year extension on the heels of that. Market inefficiency is an interesting way to look at it. I think other teams have seized on that at varying points. I think the Nashville Predators did a tremendous job with that under David Poile in the latter years of his tenure there, finding players that were cast off for one reason or another and seeing if they can help rehab that image and squeeze every drop out of them in terms of making their team and organization better. You're right. It's to throw everyone into the same bucket, I think, is probably a disservice to all of those people who have been mentioned, because for one reason or another, they're not all similar. But that said, I think your point is well made. And I think on top of that, I guess what I would stress is just put yourself, or try to put yourself, in the position of these people, of Stan Bowman. Look at what the last 3 years have been like for him. And I'm not saying feel sorry for him by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just saying, think about the leaps that people have made based on some of the discourse and reporting that's been out there on social media. If you think that these guys were actively working to try and cover up sexual assault, I just don't think that's accurate. And I think that's a grossly unfair label to put on someone in terms of making them out to be a monster. That you listen to Stan Bowman talk, you listen to people who know him well. I don't see it. And to then label him and lock him up and throw away the key, that's just not how life works.
Oh, we're chatting with Frank Saravelli. Okay, so Stan Bowman gets hired. Stan Bowman has done the work. Stan Bowman is back. Where does this leave Joel Quenneville, who also was cast off in exact similar fashion or exact same fashion. You know, we haven't heard as much, but we didn't hear much about what Stan Bowman was doing. So where does this leave Joel Quenneville?
It's a really good question, and I don't know the answer to it. I think he's done some work. I don't know the details to anywhere near the specificity that Sheldon Kennedy really kind of, you know, opened up our world to see the work that Stan Bowman's done. I haven't seen a similar sort of report or advocacy for Joel Quenneville, but I'm sure he's not really in all that different of a situation in terms of the light that's been cast upon him, in terms of his hunger to probably want to get back and work to clear his name. That was a big step that the NHL took. And by the way, an important one. I thought that for that to go on as long as it did without even a sentence from the NHL, I thought that was hugely important to get to that point where they now have the ability to work their way back. I just don't know some of the details as they relate to Joel Quenneville. And we know that with the Columbus Blue Jackets making their most recent hire, it's certainly not going to be in this cycle.
Yeah, it won't be. There was a pretty significant opening that was open a couple of months ago, and it is interesting that a couple of months later that Joel Quenneville and Stan Bowman are reinstated on July 1st. Like, did the Oilers have some insight that other teams didn't have that this reinstatement was about to take place?
I don't think so. I think July 1, we always hear from the NHL, the start of the next season, the new fiscal year. Gary Bettman had been asked about it as recently as the Stanley Cup final, and he said that he had to make a decision on it, quote, real soon. So he knew that it was a sort of front burner issue that at some point needed to have some judgment one way or the other. Either these guys have an ability to come back, or if not, you at least need to give them a date that they can work towards in order to come back and to sort of sit in limbo there. I think he realized, and a lot of other people realized, that that was probably a tough spot to be in. So in terms of the Oilers having intel or knowledge, no, look, they were going to press forward. Jeff Jackson wasn't going to be the guy that continued to be the GM of this team. He made that clear, despite how good his summer was to this point, that he wanted to be the GM of this team, and they would have pressed forward and hired someone else had Stan Bowman not been available.
Let's switch gears here. Taxes in the NHL has been a hot topic this week. Dan Robson, The Athletic, with a interesting article outlining all that. I know this has been reported as a non-issue, but as people continue to talk about it, I wonder if it's going to come to the fore in any way. CBA, you know, we're not there yet. Nothing can really change. But is this an issue at all? The taxes and how they give advantages to other teams? Or is it like it's always been where, yeah, this thing isn't changing and there's no reason to really look at it?
Well, there's a number of teams around the NHL who would want the NHL to look at it because they feel like there are unfair advantages for teams in the no state income tax states. I would say that it's not easy or cut and dry in terms of implementing some changes. You're talking about dollars in, dollars out on the cap. You're talking about a complex maneuverability, a formula that the league would have to implement. And not for nothing, I don't think the league really, perhaps more importantly than anything GMs think or agents think, I don't think the league views this as a serious issue that needs to be managed or dealt with. There's a lot of agents who you talk to around the league who say the tax situation is really kind of overblown. If you have a really good accountant who knows what they're doing and knows the intricacies of U.S. and Canadian tax law, that ultimately in the end, we're talking about really only a couple bucks either way being a big difference in terms of the net pay that goes into a player's pocket. So there's all sorts of methods and avenues that players use to their advantage, including at times, you know, spending a chunk of their year in no state income tax states or claiming residency somewhere else. There's a million ways you can do it, but they view it, agents at least, as mostly overblown.
Frank, my body needs to talk to you about Mitch Marner because, like, hearing your voice, like, there's just cells that activate, right? And we've had a million conversations about him. We're almost in August, and, yeah, there hasn't been much scuttlebutt. I suppose it could ramp back up, but are we in this place where it just feels like that's over and he has the full no move and he's going to play out the year as a Toronto Maple Leaf, or could this story reignite?
Famous last words to say it's over, so I'm not certainly at this juncture, July 24th, willing to declare that. There's still plenty of runway left in the offseason and still tons of cap space out there in terms of certain teams having an ability and or want to get better. I will say that I checked in on the Mitch Marner file a few days ago, and the most recent answer I got was nothing new. So I think we're kind of in the same place, Ben, that we were, you know, a few weeks ago on the other side of the draft and free agency, where at this point in time, I don't believe there's much cooking. I do think the Leafs had engaged in varying discussions with some teams to find out what the price or the market might be for Mitch Marner, but obviously nothing that suited them to the point that they could take it back to the Marner camp and say, hey, here's something that we'd be willing to do. It never even advanced to that stage, to my knowledge. So at this point, we sit and wait, and it's a story, a powder keg that is kind of just waiting.
So is there an interest problem in Mitch Marner?
I don't think there's an interest problem. I think it's a, for both teams, whoever, you know, is on the other end of this, it's complicated, right? You've got, and we've talked about the nuances of this for months, you've got a player who needs an extension. You don't want to trade all these assets to get 1 year of Mitch Marner. You've got an enticement issue, I should say, where how do you entice Mitch Marner that's the place that he wants to be? Mm-hmm. That's one part of it. And then you've got the other end of it for the Toronto Maple Leafs, which is, what are you getting in return for who you believe is one of the 15 or 20 best players in the NHL? How are you making your team better in this exact moment in time? It's not an interest issue. It's a how does everyone leave this table feeling happy issue.
Speaking of extensions, Leon Draisaitl needs one. And now his team has a general manager. Is that the number one item for Stan Bowman immediately?
100%. The Edmonton Oilers had left it to Stan Bowman, whoever the next GM was going to be. They engaged in what I would call initial cordial, friendly conversations right at the very beginning of the Stanley Cup final between Leon Draisaitl's agent and also top Oilers brass, including Jeff Jackson. I think Draisaitl has said all the right things, but Jeff Jackson had left it at the point where we need to bring in the next guy, whoever that is, to have him run point on this, because from a cap perspective, from an everything perspective, he's also going to need to be comfortable with this moving forward in terms of how he shapes his roster and team. We'd like more eyes on this. And Stan Bowman has plenty of experience negotiating some big boy contracts, including the Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews deals, the first sort of massive twin $80 million deals in that max term era that really set the table for the Chicago Blackhawks for the future.
Do you think he'll sign before McDavid?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, for sure.
Yeah? So you don't think he's waiting on exactly what his best friend's doing?
I mean, then he's a free agent, right?
Well, that's what I was going to say. At that point, the way the calendar works, he would become a free agent next July 1, so it wouldn't be possible.
Well, you know, within the same week. You know what I mean? Like, Draisaitl has to go first if he's not going to see free agency. But, you know, he's in an interesting position because I think he would want clarity from Connor McDavid. I'm sure he probably has clarity from Connor McDavid, but if he moves too quickly, I guess you leave the door open for something to change.
I'll answer it this way, Justin. Make no mistake, if Leon Draisaitl, if and when he signs an extension, he will do so with the full knowledge that his best friend and top player in the world will soon be following at some point whenever eligible with his own extension. How about that?
So it'll be twice the good news for the Edmonton Oilers if they can get that done before July 1. Frank, it was a pleasure catching up in the summer. Summer Frank is good Frank in my books. We appreciate the time, and we'll do this again soon.
See you guys.
It's Frank Cervelli of DailyFaceoff.com. Yeah, that's, I mean, I think, especially with Jeff Jackson, everyone expected this to resolve itself and that these two are moving in lockstep. But it didn't happen on July 1 when it could have.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, we're hiring Stan Bowman and they're moving parts here. But it seems like Jeff Jackson has just as much control and persuasion and influence on this situation as anyone. I wonder why it hasn't happened yet, but I don't really question what the Oilers are going to accomplish when it comes to these two, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, the Draisaitl extension feels like those NBA extensions where it's like, hey, you just fill your name in on the contract because it's a max deal and it's...
But it's a max that comes in slightly under
his teammate. But that's what I mean. It seems like it's a paint-by-numbers contract negotiation that, yeah, you basically hand it over to Leon. And what is the term? I guess the term is the thing that could be interesting if he decides not to take a full 8 years. If he wants to go five or fewer, that could change things. But Stan Bowman's not going to have a different opinion on whether he wants to retain Leon Draisaitl at an exorbitant sum than Jeff Jackson. They're going to be thinking the same thing. And I get what Frank's saying, that when you're hiring a general manager, you don't want to do the biggest thing that he is going to be asked to do before he puts pen to paper. But yeah, this one feels like the ball is entirely in Leon Draisaitl's court. If he wants to extend, the Oilers, it's hard to imagine them getting to a point where there's some number that Leon wants that is unsustainable. If that's the case, then he is telling the Oilers he doesn't want to be an Edmonton Oiler, and I have no indication that that's the case. This does feel like if in fact Leon Draisaitl wants to be an Oiler, that should be done pretty quickly, but it hasn't happened yet. We're almost in August.
And they also have to make the decision, if it is in tandem, of how competitive they want the Oilers to be. Maybe it helps.
Well, yeah.
Negotiation if they win a Stanley Cup this year. Leon Draisaitl will be 29 in October.
Mm-hmm.
So just as the season's getting underway, I wonder if they go 5-6. I wonder if they do the full. Like, there are a lot of things that have to sort themselves out. But again, I expect them to do it in the exact same way.
It's so interesting, too, that they get the general manager from the Chicago team that won the Cups, but immediately upon signing those $80 million extensions, the winning stopped, right?
They got nothing out of those extensions.
Yeah.
Those were, plain and simple, legacy contracts.
Sure. I mean, I'm sure they hope to continue winning.
Yeah.
But, it was a lot more palatable, obviously, for Blackhawks fans.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that was the example we all cited when you looked at teams that had top-loaded cap structures. And here's the architect of that. Now, he was also the architect of the Cup-winning teams, but put in a similar position in Edmonton when you got Leon Draisaitl and Connor McDavid.
We got 2 minutes. As mentioned in our conversation with Arash Madani, Andre DeGrasse and Maud Charron will carry the flag for Canada on Friday at the opening ceremonies. There will be no walking. They'll be holding it as a boat carries them through the opening ceremonies, which is cool, but worthy choices. DeGrasse, defending 200-meter champion, owner of 6 Olympic medals. Charron, also a defending gold medalist, but as Arash Madani noted, will have to change her weight class this year. But yeah, we've reached the point now, we were discussing it yesterday, like you gotta be an Olympic gold medalist to be given this honor.
Yeah.
Because before it was like, you've been at 4 Olympics. What an incredible ambassador of the sport. No longer. You got to accomplish something if you want this sort of honor.
Yeah, and Andre DeGrasse, already the most decorated male Summer Olympic athlete in this country's history. And as Arash mentioned, Penny Oleksiak, the all-time leader with 7 Olympic medals. So one more to tie her and 2 more to surpass her. And to have never been given that honor before, he seemed like an obvious no-brainer. That's the thing. There's just such an incredible wealth of options when it comes to great, great Olympic stories. I don't know if you could go wrong. They definitely didn't with these two selections.
Not a great Olympic story before the Olympics start for Canada at Paris 2024. Of course, the Canadian women's soccer team begins their title defense tomorrow, but does so under a pretty dark cloud. Bev Priestman will not be managing. She will not be on the touchline. We'll see where all this goes, but we do know that 2 staffers sent back home. Priestman not on the touchline tomorrow, and I guess we'll find out tomorrow how this is going to affect the team's performance. We will discuss that on Friday, but you'll be on the Fan Morning Show tomorrow, so we appreciate you jumping on today, and we'll chat on Friday.